All right.
We're ready to go.
You're rolling?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go.
Roll the tape.
I'm excited. I banged it four times. Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today is March 19, 2013. First bill up today is Senator Sharon's bill, Senate File 422.
Good afternoon. I'm here with Senate File 422, which is called the Family Reunification Act of 2013. I have with me two testifiers who have been working for a long time with respective organizations to bring this legislation forward. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, I will ask them to articulate the history and the context out of which this bill is coming forward to you and to go through the details of the bill. So with that, I'd introduce John Choi from Ramsey County Attorney.
County Attorney Choi, welcome.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here today in support of Senate File 422, and I want to thank Senator Sharon for bringing this matter forward. This, as Senator Sharon talked about, this issue has been before the legislature for quite some time, and the county attorneys have in the past been opposed to this bill for a number of really important reasons, but I think we've gotten to a place where we have come to a compromise, recognizing that we do need to create some sort of statutory procedure in which these situations in which there is a child who is in foster care who has never, ever been adopted and is 15 years of age, and it's been 3 years since the time of the order to terminate parental rights has passed, that we have some process in place by which consideration could be made to think about what would be the best interest of the child. And ultimately, that's what we're trying to accomplish here. But the previous objections of the county attorneys is that, as some of you may know, when county attorneys take that extraordinary step to terminate a parental rights, that's an extraordinary situation. And typically, the facts of those situations are just horrific and horrible. And bad things have happened to a child, and there have been many chances that have been given to try to bring the child and the parent back together, but for reasons relative to what is in the best interest of the child, the rights of the parents are terminated. And when that happens, I think one of the most important things is that everybody who is involved, especially that child, we do everything in our power to make sure that they get adopted as quickly as possible. But for many situations in the state of Minnesota, we're not successful in finding adoptive homes for these kids. And so what this bill does is creates that mechanism by which a county attorney and the social service agency can consider whether or not there is an appropriate situation much later down the road in which there's a child who wants to be reunified with their parent, and the parent has corrected all of the conditions that contributed to the parent's rights being terminated, and they have the financial wherewithal and the capability of being a parent. And that is really, in essence, what this bill proposes to do. And again, this is a very fragile compromise that's been worked out between the county attorneys and the many, many advocates who have been advocating for this bill over the course of the past 5 years. And so with that, and there's also there's a lot of statutory protections in here, too, so that a petition would not be brought in certain situations, for instance, if there was sexual abuse, conduct that resulted in the death of a child, things of that sort. So there are very much safeguards, obvious situations in which a petition should never be brought. But at the end of the day, it was the county attorney and the social service agency that made the attempt to terminate the parental rights, and if it's appropriate later down the road, this bill allows for a process to be where consideration can be made, and then the county attorney and the social service agency can bring this matter before the court to reunify the family if it is in the best interest of the child. This will apply only to a very narrow set of circumstances. In fact, the Department of Human Services estimates that there are only 35 children who would be eligible in the state of Minnesota, and that's without considering whether or not this, in fact, is in the best interest of the child. So none of that, without doing any of that analysis, it's a very limited set of circumstances. But the good that could come for these kids is the gravity of that is large. And so although this does not affect a lot of kids in a lot of situations, I believe that this bill could do a lot of good things for those kids who are in that situation, who are about, because of their age, are about in the situation of timing out of the foster care system without ever having been adopted.
So, Mr. Choi, without this bill, there is no mechanism in law for reversing the termination of parental rights decision. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We would be, if this bill were to pass, we would be the 13th state in the nation to have a process in place. But right now, under Minnesota law, there is no process. In fact, the advice that's given to people is very contradictory. In some cases, people will tell them to readopt their kids. And in some other cases, there just won't be any provision that's identified in state law to make this happen.
Thank you.
Senator Latz,
Senator Sharon.
If I may, before introducing Ron Elwood to also speak to this bill, is to acknowledge to this body that Mr. Elwood has been working, of course, in advocacy, legal services advocacy project for a long time, and has been engaged in this conversation and working through these issues for a long time. And it really is these two people's hard work that has brought this forward for your consideration. But I also want to acknowledge Senator Hall, who was the chief author on this legislation in the past and is a co-author this year, has participated also in this journey to bring this bill forward in front of the committee today. And with that, I would turn it over to Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. And I want to thank Senator Sharon for bringing this forward and thank County Attorney Choi for working with us to get to the place where we are today. I think clients that we see, we have a youth law project at Legal Aid that kind of brought this issue to the fore 5 years ago. And some of the children we see would significantly benefit from a process like this. And so we're fully in support of this bill. And the last thing I'd like to just point out to the committee that this is a very narrowly and carefully crafted bill with a lot of safeguards in it. And among them, I'd like to just highlight the fact that in order to for the court to approve the petition, the evidentiary standard has been set at a clear and convincing evidentiary standard to ensure that the best interests of the child are met and the parent has corrected the conditions and that they are fit, able, willing, capable of providing day-to-day care and a safe, healthy environment that protects the welfare of the child. So we would urge the committee's support.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Elwood, what would happen if the parent backslides back to the previous behavior that got him in this position in the first place and the child was removed? Is there a provision in here that would allow for that, or does the whole process start all over again from day one?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, well, first of all, I think one of the important safeguards that would argue against that situation is that the child would have to be 15 to begin with to be able to even be eligible. So there had to be a significant amount of time elapse between because most of the rights. Most of these situations are where children are young, so many years have elapsed. So that's number one. But to answer your question directly, there's no specific procedure, but just like anything else, a report of that nature would trigger the proceeding and the county attorney's re-involvement in the case.
Mr. Chair, so there's nothing in this that would create like a probationary period of time. It would either be on or off. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, no.
No? No, there's no probation.
No, there. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Senator Lieberman. No, there is no probation period. I can tell you that as this bill had been heard over many years, and the age threshold was younger, there was actually a provision of that nature early on, several years ago. That bill obviously didn't make it through the process. But now that I think that the age has been moved up to 15, that provision has not been included.
Senator Latz, another component of this that might speak indirectly, not directly to the question you're answering, but in terms of the conditions under which a petition might be brought forward, is a very high standard of clear and convincing evidence that reform and change has taken place, and that would require a substantial history in order to meet that high standard.
Is there any further discussion on Senate File 422? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 422 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Senator Sieben, Senate File 1033.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 1033 came to me as a result of there is a refinery located in my district that's very close to some residential homes, and the refinery has in general been a great employer for many people in our community. But occasionally there are releases of hazardous substances that have caused concern. And so what Senate File 1033 simply does is clarify that when there is a hazardous substance release or an extremely hazardous substance, that the release must be reported to the state duty officer and to local law enforcement. Right now, under current statute, it is, as you'll see, they have the option of reporting either to the state emergency response center or local law enforcement. And so what this bill does is clarify that the duty officer and local law enforcement needs to be notified. And here with me to provide testimony and explain more why this is appropriate and needed. First is Mr. Ken Prilliman, who's the fire chief for the City of Brooklyn Park and the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association president.
Thank you. Chief Prilliman?
I'll correct it. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I am the fire chief and emergency management director for the City of Brooklyn Park, and I'm here representing State Fire Chiefs Association as well as the Minnesota State Fire Department Association. The bill that's before you closes a very critical gap that exists today. The state duty officer's mission today is not to notify local jurisdictions who have authority over emergency events. These types of events, and we've had them in Brooklyn Park as well, result in significant delays by not having a requirement that they notify both the state duty officer as well as local fire and law enforcement agencies. As we shared with a House committee, with all due respect, we're called first responders for a reason, and this material is called hazardous for a reason. It's important that we are able to respond quickly to assess the amount of release, what has been released, and certain chemicals, depending upon the even weather conditions, wind directions, whether or not it's been exposed to water, has a material impact on the potential safety of the public. Brooklyn Park, just a few months ago, we had an anhydrous ammonia leak in a facility that was reported to the state duty officer. Word did not get to us for over 6 hours. Anhydrous ammonia is a toxic inhalation hazard that with a wind change or a wind direction towards any residents or active businesses could have resulted and a lot of people being very seriously injured. And this bill, as proposed, allows local jurisdictions who have authority over responding to these events to dispatch appropriate resources as the local jurisdiction has already deemed in order to assess, mitigate, and recover from any hazardous material release. Some of the testimony related to the House file, the companion bill, suggests that there be some chemicals that we would impose this for, and other, it would be unwise to begin to try and segregate out certain chemicals or certain releases as being less toxic or less dangerous than others because of the number of chemicals that exist within our communities and exist on our roadways today. So with that, I'll pause and take any questions that the committee has.
Thank you, Chief. Senator Sieben, do you know of any opposition to this bill?
Mr. Chair, I believe there that the chamber would like to testify on the bill. I've been in touch with Tony Quillis about some
concerns he has. Okay, he's approaching behind you, Senator Sieben.
And before that, perhaps we could also hear from Kurt Lee, who's the fire chief for the city of St. Paul Park.
Of course. Welcome, Chief.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kirk Lee, Fire Chief with St. Paul Park Fire Department. I'm in support of the bill. One of the things we have is Northern Tier is one of our large refineries that are there. And Northern Tier has a responding fire department within their building, which is a good responding group. We work well with them, and we go to these scenes to assist them most likely because they're the experts in the refinery deal, but it is our jurisdiction, and we are ultimately responsible for the safety of the citizens and surrounding cities around there. What we're asking for is just not being an option of being called. We want to be on the list of priorities to be called because, just as Chief mentioned, we are first responders, and we need to be protected for the citizens and everything else to know what's going on. But time is the essence, and to be notified after an episode or halfway in between an episode or half hour into the episode can totally change results on a chemical leak or so forth. So I'm open for any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for either of the chiefs? Thank you. Mr. Quillis. Chiefs, if you both sign in, please, on the testifier sheet, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tony Quillis from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy there. And a couple of quick points. Mr. Chairman, members, I've had some brief discussions with Senator Sieben in regards to this bill, and I just wanted to point out a couple of things. Number one, the concern is that when there is a unfortunate circumstance where there is a release, there is a system set up to kind of make the one call, if you will, and that is to the duty officer. And I'm going to read from you right from the Pollution Control Agency's website that says, taking calls 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the Minnesota duty officer notifies state agencies, local government units, and other parties so they can respond in a timely manner to a spill of petroleum or hazardous material. So the first call in an unfortunate circumstance where we would have a release would be to the duty officer, and we would hope that he would then notify the local law enforcement officers. That being the first point, Mr. Chairman. Second point being, if you'll look, our concern is that after we make the phone call, we're concerned that if we don't make a second phone call in regards to the local firefighting or law enforcement organization, if you'll look on 1.8 and 1.9, it's a $25,000 fine or up to 2 years imprisonment, which is twice what the federal law is, $10,000 for $10,000 or 1 year in jail is what the federal requirements are. So those are just a couple of concerns of ours, Mr. Chairman. Also, it's a little bit easier to do here in the metropolitan area, but it's a little bit tougher to determine who the local authority is up in International Falls, if it's Couchiching County or the city of International Falls, or when we get into some of the rural areas or greater Minnesota. So those are some of our concerns. I've expressed them to Senator Sieben. I think there's a way to do this with some language helping the Minnesota duty officer notify the local governmental units. But, Mr. Chairman, those are my comments right now.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just in response to that, I'll point out two things. The first is that the duty officer, you know, all we're saying is that the when this situation happens, the duty officer should be notified and should local law enforcement. So that we're not only protecting the public safety in the most appropriate way possible, but also the first responders. There's been situations that I've been told about where the first responders don't hear, local law enforcement doesn't hear about the incident in a very timely manner from the duty officer. They might either have called, someplace else, and Chief from St. Paul Park can describe what happened with a particular situation, but we want to make sure that we're also protecting the safety of the first responders so that they're not driving up to a situation without the appropriate protective gear, for example. And to Mr. Quillis's second point, if they're unclear about who to notify, the state is covered by 911 emergency services, and it's my understanding that notifying 911 would encompass the requirements of what we are proposing.
Chief?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd also like to point out there are 785 fire departments in the state of Minnesota. Many of those fire departments, and more importantly, the underlying jurisdictions, are protected by fire districts whose name does not match the community. You will not find today a Crystal Fire Department. You will not find a New Hope Fire Department. And therefore, imposing an expectation on the state duty officer that they figure out which jurisdiction, which fire department does in fact have jurisdiction over a hazardous material release, creates potentially significant delays, if not an overwhelming challenge for the state duty officer, where today, because the entire state is covered by PSAP, Public Safety Answering Points, 911 centers, managed by our county sheriffs, those questions are not at issue. A call to 911 is easily identified in terms of the jurisdiction, both fire and police, who have authority over that particular location. So we would encourage the use of a system that works very well. It works very well for those locations who voluntarily report their hazardous material release today, and it allows us not only to route that to the appropriate agency in a very quick manner, but it allows us to already have in place response protocols established with the county sheriff in terms of how much fire and how much police response is appropriate based upon the event.
Are there any questions, Senator Goodwin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I forgot your name from the chamber.
Quillis, Tony Quillis.
Quilts?
Quillis.
Okay. I am concerned that that this would be a problem for the chamber. I would think that we need to protect the public. That's my number one concern. We have a number of Superfund sites in Fridley, and we also had a train spill last year in Fridley of hazardous materials. I think whatever it takes to make sure that that information gets out there right away, so we not only protect the responders, but we also protect the public. 6 hours is a long time, and I don't want to point fingers, but if it's as easy as calling 911 and then 911 has the responsibility to notify both, that should not be a problem for your chamber at all.
Mr. Chairman,
why?
Senator Goodwin, we're in an unfortunate incident that release occurs, it is number one priority for us. We don't want them to happen either. It is a number one priority for us to, number one, protect the employees. Number two, yes, protect the first responders that are coming. And that is why under federal law, as well as under state law, we are required to call the duty officer. That is not a problem. We do that. And then we also report, Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, we err on the side of caution because of the extraordinary strict penalties here of $25,000 and 2 years in jail. Our members, because if you look on page 2 on 2.1 and 2.2, we're referencing federal reportable quantities. So we err on the side of even if we tip over a beaker that is under reportable quantities, we still report it because of the strict federal penalties. So the question is whether reportable quantity, what's the quantity that was spilled? But yes, I agree with you. In an unfortunate incident of a release, we want to make sure that our employees are protected, the environment and natural resources are protected, and that the first responders know what they're walking into. That's not a problem. We want to call the duty officer. It's a matter of how that information gets down to the first responders. Because usually when this happens, as the chiefs have pointed out, it's not, you know, there's not a lot of timeline. We want to get on the situation and correct it.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Well, I just want to say that I think this is an important bill, and any way we can protect the public is important to me.
Any further questions or comments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
On line 9, existing language refers to a person who is required to report the release. Who would that person be in a situation?
What line are you looking at?
On 1.9 and 1.10 of the existing language refers to who is required to report the lease. Who is that person that is required to
report? Mr. Chair.
Senator Seaman.
I would assume that it's the operator of the facility or whoever's in charge of the operation of that facility, but perhaps counsel could help on that since I don't we're not obviously amending that. Perhaps counsel could help.
Static electricity.
Mr. Chair, members, there are a number of references to federal law in current state law, and perhaps one of the witnesses might know better, but my understanding is under federal law, I believe a person in charge of a vessel or an offshore or onshore facility shall, as soon as he has knowledge of the release, make the report. So I think it would be someone who is in the federal law looks like it says in charge of.
Mr. Chairman, I would also point counsel to Minnesota Administrative Rules 7045.0574, Emergency Procedures. At all times, a facility must have at least one employee on the facility or on call with the responsibility of coordinating all emergency response measures.
The only reason I asked, Ms. Chair, is that I just wanted to know if it was the CEO of the corporation or is it someone who's on staff, on site all the time?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I would assume it was an employee that is on site and is qualified and has gone through training.
Sure. Right.
Any further questions or discussion?
Mr. Chair.
We have one coming up behind you, Senator Seaman. Mr. Appitz.
My name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and I represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. What you just heard is the complexity that this causes for a stationary facility. For mobile operations, railroad, trucks, any entity that's carrying hazardous materials would have a responsibility for reporting this. And the one concern I would have is that you might need a little more specificity as to how you go about doing this. If 911 is the number to call, this isn't a bad idea, but if 911 is the number to call, then that should probably be specified because I think it'd be unreasonable within the context of the penalties, et cetera, that you provide here to assume that whomever is running the train, driving the truck, would know who the local firefighter or the law enforcement organization having jurisdiction over the location where the releases occurs would know who that fire chief or that police chief might be. So if 911 is the way you want to go about doing this, I think it might be good to specify that. I just suggest otherwise it's going to be – there's some pretty serious penalties here if somebody doesn't contact the police chief or the fire department in East Elephant Breath, Minnesota, when there's a spill.
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This is the first I heard of these concerns, but I would ask counsel to clarify. You'll see that what we're doing is specifying that they need to, as is current law right now, is they have to notify the state emergency response center or law enforcement organization. And so all we're really doing is adding and the local firefighting or law enforcement organization. So I would assume that under that, the new language, that a law enforcement organization having jurisdiction over the location of the release would include a 911 center. But if Mr. Backus could clarify that.
Mr. Backus has drafted some language that perhaps might address this.
Mr. Chair, members, if you wanted to be specific about it, on line 1.17 after end, if you inserted call 911 to report the release to, then would make it quite clear that the actual 911 call would satisfy that second clause there.
Senator Sieben?
Mr. Chair, that would be, I would ask that a member please move that for me.
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin moves that amendment. Any discussion on that? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Is there any further testimony? Any members of the audience wish to be heard on this bill?
Just change this to see.
Is there a motion on the bill?
I make the motion, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 1033 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben, Senate File 768.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 768 is very similar to a bill that was signed into law last year and received overwhelming bipartisan support for a waiver of liability for negligent conduct that was related specifically to trucking contracts, I believe. What Senate File 768 does, this is the way that, let me back up a little bit. The way I understand it is whenever I sign my child up for to go to a birthday party or to go to a water park, you have to sign a waiver of liability that talks about the inherent risk in the activity, and in some cases also talks about, if you look at it closely, talks about the negligent. You're also signing a waiver of liability for the negligent operation, maintenance, or design of the property. And so what this bill would do would prohibit the or make those waiver of liabilities void only for the portion where we're talking about the negligent operation, maintenance, or design of the party's premises. Representative Mary Liz Holberg is carrying this bill in the House, and she described it, I think came up with a good example as it was told to me. This isn't saying that when she takes her grandsons to a water park that she could still sign a waiver of liability, recognizing that there are inherent risks in taking your child or grandson to a water park facility. And obviously, that's fine. That's the nature of the situation. But either an individual or a person acting on behalf of a minor should not sign away the liability of damages that could arise out of the negligent operation or maintenance of the water park facility. So as Representative Holberg pointed out, it's one thing if the child, you know, is messing around and does something that they shouldn't do at the water park. It's another thing if there are screws sticking out of the water slide and those screws, because of the negligent operation or the negligent maintenance of the water slide, injure that child. And so in summary, I think that's generally what what this bill proposes to do. And if we could please hear from the testifier, they can describe more accurately the reasons behind the legislation.
Thank you. Mr. Flegel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Will Flegel. I'm from Maple Grove. I'm an attorney practicing in Minneapolis. I'm past president of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and for the last 12 years I've organized and presented at the Law School for Legislators at William Mitchell College of Law that I believe some of you have attended. I'm here to support Senate File 768. What I'd like to do is to provide sort of a general overall legal perspective here for the history of this type of waiver, its proliferation, and how Senate File 768 would make a modest change in the law that provides for a limited avenue of relief to consumers. So with your permission, one of the handouts I believe you may have is an example of the assumption of risk and indemnity agreement. It's a yellow highlighted single sheet, and that reflects the nature for your further review of the type of conduct that is insulated. And I think many of us as consumers have had this common experience where if you wish to participate in a certain activity, you're asked to sign a release waiver. Lawyers would call it an exculpatory agreement or an indemnification agreement. And what they universally purport to do is to say, if we do anything here at this facility that is negligent and it causes you injury, you may not make a claim against us. The actual historic origin of this type of agreement is in the construction industry, where if I'm a subcontractor, in order to gain a bid, I would seek out a job, and a general contractor may say, well, I'll let you have that, but you have to promise to indemnify me if I, as the general contractor, do anything wrong. In 1983, this body enacted a statute to limit the scope of those types of exculpatory agreements or indemnification agreements in the construction industry as part of 33702. And I understand that this is the first, actually, of three bills that you'll be hearing today that relate to limitations on indemnification-type agreements. In 2012, as Senator Sieben indicated, this body enacted modifications to 221.87, Senate File 1687, which was carried by Senator Ortman, that provided the same sort of basic protections that if there's a negligent act and it results in injury, that type of waiver agreement cannot be used in the motor carrier transport industry. With regard to consumers, however, we have no legislative enacted protections, and we're left to the determinations of the courts to resolve the issue of whether or not any given activity should be allowed to be exculpated by this type of a waiver. The case law that results, I'm going to very quickly cover five cases with you. Going back to 1986, the Malacca case is a skydiving case in which a waiver was signed by a participant at a skydiving school. The parachute was negligently packed. It did not open properly. There was an injury. The injured consumer was not allowed to sue because the exculpatory agreement that waived responsibility for negligence was enforced. This bill would not change that result because this bill contains an exception for inherent risks of activities. If you look at the bill, its main focus is to address issues related to property and specifically the operation, maintenance, or design of that property. The example that Senator Sieben provided is a good one, in that in the event there was some condition of the property which the consumer could not expect and that resulted in injury, they would be permitted under this bill to make a claim for ordinary negligence. Another case, Powell from 1999, is a dangerous premises case in which someone went on a tour. They went to a specific hotel selected for them by the tour company and the balcony on which they were standing collapsed. They had, however, signed a waiver agreement agreeing that they would not sue for any act of ordinary negligence, including the failure to take care of the property. This bill would potentially change that result in that the condition of the property, if there was a maintenance issue or a design issue, may enable the individual to make a claim. The Anderson case in 2006 is a dangerous activities case. It occurred at a sports-type club facility where a woman had enlisted the assistance of a special trainer to help her use the equipment properly. She reported to the trainer that she was experiencing pain and was advised to work through her pain. She did and was injured. Because she had signed a waiver agreement promising not to sue for ordinary negligence, she was barred from making a claim. This bill could potentially change that in the event that the outcome was dictated by how the equipment was operated by an individual. In the Moore case from 2009, a family gave their child a gift of participation in a baseball clinic. They recognized going into the situation that they were going to be made to sign a release that says, much like you used to hear at the Metrodome and now here at Target Field, if you're hit by a batted or thrown ball, you have no remedy. But their son lost his eye when a fellow at an unsupervised lunch picked up a decorative wood chip and threw it at him. They thought that the release agreement they had signed should not be so broad as to also encompass that activity, and the court disagreed and enforced the waiver agreement barring any remedy because the incident occurred as part of the clinic. The last case I'll mention is a Resnick decision from 2010. That was another injury at a gym, but occurred where construction dust had fallen onto the handball floor. The individual who slipped and was injured acknowledged that since he had signed a release, he expected that if he was injured in the course of ordinary athletic activities, he would not be able to sue, but the construction dust was something to his mind new and different. The court disagreed and enforced the waiver agreement, barring any claim for acts of ordinary negligence. These types of matters have proliferated significantly, and I would submit that therefore there is a justification to afford the same protection to consumers that exists in the context of taking care of the construction industry or motor transport carriers. The last part I'll visit with you about are what I perceive as the three limitations that limit the scope and nature of the remedies in this bill. The first is that it only applies to premises and not activities. So, for example, if there was a concern that, for example, a soccer club might not be able to effectively conduct its activities anymore for fear of a claim unless the soccer club happened to own the property where the incident was occurring, that concern would not be a real one. The other limitation that's significant is that the bill still preserves as something for which these exculpatory clauses may be used, inherent risks associated with activities. So any risky endeavors, whether that's skating, skiing, inner tubing, go-karting, if the activity itself results in injury and carried an inherent risk, those kinds of risks would be something for which the assumption of risk agreement that I referenced earlier would still protect. This bill would only address the ability of a consumer to sue in the event that the condition of the property in terms of the operation, maintenance, or design increased or enlarged that risk. The last consideration I'll mention to you is that recreational facilities, for example, that are owned or maintained by the state, a county, or a city, those entities as owners of property are afforded protections under our state immunity laws in Chapter 466, specifically 466.03 sub 6E for recreational immunity. And there are also caps on damages in the event that a governmental entity is found responsible under 466.04. So in terms of the scope of the bill, it is fairly limited and focused. It still allows the use of these kinds of devices in activities which carry with them inherent risks and dangers. But it affords a measure of relief to a consumer where something unexpected is encountered because of an error in the maintenance, operation, or design of premises. For those reasons, Mr. Chair and members, the Association for Justice supports the bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Flegel?
Yes.
Senator Sharon.
Did I understand you to say that in terms of government's recreational facilities like swimming pools or water slides or ballparks or whatever, that they continue, nothing in this bill changes the immunity that they experience under current law or the caps that are afforded to local government?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, you're correct. Nothing in this bill alters that. The immunities that exist under Chapter 466, there are 34 of them. There's one specifically that addresses recreational immunity. That's not affected by this. I mentioned immunity merely as a matter of reassuring that those concerned that this may somehow adversely impact government, that those would be misplaced concerns, primarily because this bill focuses on property, not activities on property, and the immunities that exist to government remain in place.
Senator Latz.
Senator Sharon.
And in general, one of the things, not specific to this bill, but whenever this kind of issue comes forward, that I'm listening for is the opportunity for someone to pursue a suit and negotiate a settlement rather than go through the costs of court, which are very expensive. And I'm just very familiar that there is the use of this kind of process, even when there's not a legitimate claim that might not make it through a court process, but because of costs, a settlement occurs. And I find that really a disturbing misuse of the legal process, that you hold somebody to paying out money for something to avoid a larger cost. I don't know if I feel very assured that that isn't part of what we will be opening up here, and I'd like you to speak to that issue.
Mr. Flagel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I'd be happy to. In terms of the issues here, if we look at what the bill seeks to remedy, it seeks to address a written kind of waiver or agreement that you or I or anyone may be asked to sign before we participate in a certain kind of activity. And it says to us that in the event that the owner of that property does something negligent to us, something that any one of us would normally have a remedy in the world at large, driving about in our cars or elsewhere, that remedy is removed because we've signed the piece of paper. And unless you're a lawyer who is, you know, is scrutinizing each document that's placed before you as you go up the ski lift or enter the go-kart park, you're probably not even aware of the rights that you're giving up. What this bill essentially does is to return people to the status that they would have had, as we would say, at common law. If someone does a negligent act to you, you have the right of redress under our Constitution and our common law to seek just compensation where someone else's negligence causes you injury. And the courts are obviously the mechanism that that redresses that concept. I hope I've addressed your question adequately. If not, I'd be happy to answer anything else.
Senator Lutz, I understood what you were saying was the purpose of the bill, but I'm not sure that my general concept is resolved in what you've said. But the last question that I have is, when is the next law school for legislators?
Give it every two.
Did I just miss one?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, we give it every 2 years, and you just missed the last one. So. The hors d'oeuvres, I understand, were particularly good.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Senator Sharon, perhaps in response to part of your concern, you know, we at the legislature can set the rules of liability and whatever systems are out there for resolving disputes or any other systems where we set rules. They're subject to some abuse in certain circumstances or claims that may not be fully justified in whatever the context is. And we can only do so much here. I think the question before the committee is, what should the rules be? And then there are protections, especially within the judicial system, you know, Rule 11 sanctions for lawyers who bring claims that don't have any basis in law, and so on. But the same questions that you raised could be raised in questions of automobile injury claims or any other injury claims, slip and fall claims. On the other hand, with this kind of a waiver in place, if your child went down a water slide at the water park and the water park itself had failed to maintain that slide properly, and as a result the slide broke, the child fell 10 feet and broke his back, you would have no claim against the water park because you'd signed away your rights. Same with regard to going to Camp Snoopy or whatever they call it now out at the Mall of America. Or if you were on a ski lift at Afton Alps and they hadn't maintained the ski lift properly and the lift itself fell off the cable and fell 20 feet. You'd have no claim if you'd signed a waiver like this.
It's just not
Senator Latz, for discussion purposes, for clarifying, without complete understanding of what the immunity is for governments in terms of their recreational facilities, why aren't those same are those same immunities extended to others who are providing recreational facilities?
That's a question of why government is distinguished from the private sector, and there's a large policy discussion about why we have limitations and governmental immunities of all sorts, including recreational immunity.
And that may be more than we want to talk about now, but it is emerges in my mind as we're listening to this conversation.
Sure. We're going to Senator Ortman. I know you had your hand up, but I want to remind members who testify at the table to please turn off your phones. Senate media is reporting that they're causing some interference with the broadcast of the audio. Senator Ortman, and then
thank you,
Senator
Mr. Chair. I do disagree with your assessment, Mr. Chair, the examples. I don't think that they're exactly accurate, and I'm sure we'll hear from others that will talk about those specific examples. But my question is for Mr. Flegel. I'm not sure how you
rhymes
pronounce.
With legal.
All right, Mr. Legal Flegel.
It's a good marketing term.
Yes. This is a different context, I think, than with the contractors. And, yes, I carried that legislation last year. This is a different context because I'm a member of Lifetime, or I might have been a member of the YMCA and been asked to sign a waiver of liability. I don't have to. It's a choice that I make. And when I sign that contract, I'm negotiating what is going to happen with respect to a lawsuit. But there are certain rights that I have to bring a lawsuit that I can't waive, and Lifetime or YMCA or somebody else can't ask me to waive certain of those rights. And one of them is they can't give me a very vague agreement like this because the court would interpret it and say it's vague and it can't be enforced. And if they ask me to sign a waiver that goes too far, that actually isn't supported in law, the court won't enforce that either. And so I think we should limit the conversation we're having to what is the current law and what will change. But there, I don't believe that your bill, I think your bill will change the relationship and allow for or limit the ability to have legally binding waivers of liability, and that will make all those services more expensive. It will certainly lead to additional lawsuits. It certainly will lead to additional settlements. It will lead to additional insurance claims, and it will make the cost of going to those types of facilities more for everyone. Isn't that true?
Mr. Flew.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree with some of the premises that you set out. I do agree that in the law, in fact, our common law, going back to the Schoblum versus Spa Petit case in the 1960s, some of the principles that you were describing are expressed by our Supreme Court, that a release cannot be too broad. But the example that we were all looking at is one that has been enforced by the courts as not overextended, as not too vague. And what it says is, if we do anything negligent that harms you, you cannot sue us. And those who speak on behalf of consumers are very concerned about that. And we do see parallels between that and other industries. If it's important to protect the construction industry so that they are not confronted by this type of an agreement, for ordinary negligence. We would respectfully submit that consumers as well should be in that same position. With regard to the issues of where by law in Minnesota the line is in terms of going too far, it would be for any written agreement that purported to protect for intentional acts of wrong. That is by case law. But in terms of other things, wherever there's just ordinary negligence, the law allows people, assuming that the consumer is on an equal bargaining footing with the entity with whom they're dealing, so that when you bring the van load of kids to whatever occasion, that as you are paying the admission price, you are free to stand in the line and negotiate, well, we will go forward and I will pay my admission if you delete paragraph 3 on the back of the admission ticket. Realistically, I would submit that that kind of equal bargaining position does not exist in the consumer world, as it does in the construction industry. And if we're affording these protections to construction in the motoring industry, where you have two major business entities arguing about who gets the right to do a project or ship goods, where I believe that that equal footing exists, I respectfully don't see it in the consumer industry.
Senator Orman.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Flegel, if I'm a mom going to a birthday party, right, at some birthday party place that hosts equipment, play equipment, and things like that, somebody hands me a waiver of liability, I can choose not to have my son participate in the games. I don't have to. And that's the difference, I think. I think that is the bargaining power. I get to know what you're asking me to waive. And if I think that there's an inherent danger to my son in that equipment, I should just say no, and I don't have to do it.
Senator Cole.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Orban, I don't mean to belabor the point, but so your hypothetical in response to Mr. Flegel is that if you go with your children to a facility, you as somebody educated as a lawyer will bargain with the facility owner, and if it's not to your satisfaction, then you're going to turn to your kids and say, well, too bad, I couldn't affect a contract that is satisfactory. So you make Mr. Flegel's point that the consumer, the individual involved in this situation is at a significantly less than equal basis in negotiation of whatever it is. And the reality is that because I listened to your comment and then I pulled out the release, which I hadn't seen before, and realized that this has been upheld. This is not in any way vague and going to be tossed out by a court.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I can answer,
Senator Orban.
The mom in that situation isn't going to negotiate the language in the agreement. The mom is just going to decide, well, this is too dangerous for my child.
Right.
And I don't want my child to participate. That's a reasonable thing for a parent, a reasonable decision for a parent to make.
Senator Orban, let me suggest that your children will not be going to very many birthday parties under those circumstances.
Mr. Chair, they went to many of them. In fact, I never said no, never. And none of them got injured, and I never had a lawsuit.
Let me suggest, Senator Ortman, that your hypothetical said that dealt with inherent risks in there, and that's different than what this is purporting. These are risks of negligent conduct, of the maintenance of the facility falling below the standard of care. And I would submit to you probably 99% of the parents who bring their kids to these facilities fully believe that if the facility messed up and didn't tighten down the bolts or didn't properly maintain the equipment and their kid got injured because of that, that they'd have a right to sue. And they would find out later in the defense as they're waiving the liability waiver saying, sorry.
Mr. Chair, that's not an accurate statement. I don't believe that's the current state of the law, but we have other experts here that can testify to that. But if I believe that if the equipment is being maintained in a reckless manner, I would still have a lawsuit.
Reckless, but negligence,
right?
You would not under
if
the waivers.
It's inherent in the activity.
No, not inherent in the activity.
Well, that's what we're going to hear from the experts
Mr. Chair. Senator Ortman, the bill addresses negligent maintenance of the premises.
I've read the bill, Mr. Chair. Maybe the other testifiers can speak to the issue.
All right, Senator
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, this is the way I think of it. And you'll look at, if you look at lines 1. The end of 1.8 through 1.10, if you go to ski, if you take your child to ski at a skiing facility and the child falls because they fall over and injure themselves because they hit a patch of ice, for example, you can still, under the legislation, you would still have no claim because the injuries were resulting from the inherent risk of skiing. But as the chairman said earlier, if your child falls off the chairlift because they didn't properly maintain the chairlift, then that is where you should not, as a parent, have waived the liability because the chairlift was negligently operated or maintained. And so that's the distinction that I think is critical in this bill. There's still some protections for the business to say that it's severable, the agreement is severable for risks that are inherent in the activity, but not for the operation or maintenance of the premise or the facility.
Senator Sieben, there are some persons that have signed up to testify in opposition to the bill. In fact, I have eight people on my list. I have a suspicion that they each have somewhat similar things to say. So what I'm going to do is I'll invite as many as want to come forward in the first group, and I'm going to try to limit this portion of the presentation about 10 or 15 minutes so that we don't get redundant. We don't need to hear the same thing from each person just identifying a different organization. So I'm not going to cut anyone off, but we don't need too much redundancy. So I'll just go down the list in the order that I have it. Eric Linseth, David Dominick, Dan McElroy, and then that's probably as many as will fit around the table at this point. Mr. Flegel, why don't you grab a seat in the audience, and we'll make more room for those who wish to testify in opposition right now, and then if there are further questions, we can address them as they arise. So I only saw two people approach. I see Mr. McElroy, Mr. Linseth.
That's right.
Okay,
Senator
is David
Lass,
Dominick here from the YMCA? Okay, then why don't we ask Patrick Hines to come forward also to the other chair that's available from the League of Minnesota Cities. And Mr. Linseth, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I very much appreciate the audience. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Eric Linseth. I'm the general counsel at Lifetime Fitness. As you probably know, we're a homegrown company here. We've got 25 health and fitness clubs in Minnesota, as well as a number of clubs throughout the United States. We strongly oppose this bill, along with a very broad coalition of businesses, public entities, and nonprofit organizations that utilize waivers of liability. Mr. Flegel testified that this would return consumers to a common law status. Well, in fact, the common law in Minnesota for the last 30 years has allowed Minnesotans to agree to waive ordinary negligence claims in return for the opportunity to participate in purely voluntary recreational activities. That has been the common law rule for three decades in Minnesota since 1982, the Spa Petit case. Only a tiny minority of states, I found only three in my review of all 50 states, have passed a statute that even arguably restricts waivers as thoroughly as Senate File 768 would do so. And none of our sister states around us, not North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin, not even Nebraska, Michigan, or Illinois has done something like this. In Minnesota, they all allow the use of recreational waivers under criteria that have been developed by their courts. So the Spa Petit case was actually not in the 1960s, as Mr. Flegel suggested. It was in 1982. Our Minnesota Supreme Court reached the conclusion that it was fair to allow a provider to ask the consumer to waive only ordinary negligence claims. That's it. Nothing more than that, in exchange for the opportunity to participate in risky, hard-to-insure recreational activities or volunteer activities at a lower cost. And that's a trade they've struck for the last three decades. Now, let's just briefly talk about the public policy, because I think the policy behind this rule makes sense.
So first, I'm going to interrupt you real quickly. Could you, how do you spell the name of that case?
Schlobohm. It's a little tricky. It's S-C-H-L-O-B-O-H-M. Schlobohm versus Spa Petite. It was a case involving a health club.
Spa?
Yep, Spa Petite.
Spa Petite.
Petite. That's correct, Mr. Chair. That was the name of the... That's the seminal case on waivers in Minnesota, recreational waivers.
And they said it was fair, or they said it was legal to be able to do
it? It's legal. It established the common law rule, and the court... I'll talk about why the court... I don't know that the court uses the word fair, but the court sets out the criteria for enforcement of waivers, and there are policy discussions in that seminal case.
The reason I ask is there's a big difference between what's legal and what necessarily may be a Supreme Court pronouncement of what is fair.
Yes.
So I'm drawing the distinction.
Mr. Chairman, and it's a fair distinction, and the Supreme Court obviously is making a policy judgment in reviewing the waivers of liability that were used by Spa Petite. And this committee's function, obviously, is to also debate the policy of the state. I hope that we can have a robust and fair discussion, though, on a fair playing field. And it is true that for 30 years, the Minnesota Supreme Court has allowed recreational waivers to be utilized. And many organizations, both small businesses and large, as well as government entities, including cities and counties, as well as nonprofit organizations like Habitat for Humanity, utilizes waivers of liability. And one of the reasons why is that recreational activities are purely voluntary. This goes to Senator Ortman's point. You never have to sign a waiver if you don't want to sign one. That's as simple as it can be put. You don't have to join Lifetime Fitness to exercise. You don't have to run in an athletic event. You can run a 5K on your own. You can buy your own home equipment, and you can stream a video in your basement. You can bear the risk of that. You don't have to put your kids in a summer camp program or a sports program. You can camp on your own, as I often do with my kids. And you don't have to volunteer for Habitat for Humanity or like a wilderness inquiry where they take disabled kids on camping trips. They ask you to sign a waiver. You can just donate money online. And you don't have to rent a jet ski or an ATV or a snowmobile or a bike from a resort. Those are things you don't have to do. They're purely voluntary. Instead, you can just read a book if that's what you'd like to do. And so the courts are very clear. They draw this distinction between voluntary recreational activities and activities that are essential or necessary. If it is an essential or a necessary service, the courts have already said you cannot be asked to sign a waiver. So your employer, for example, cannot ask you to sign a waiver of liability for negligent conduct. A common carrier like a bus or a light rail cannot ask for one. A hospital or a public utility, those are areas where waivers are off limits. And so the public policy on this is it makes some sense. The state has a stronger interest, I would submit, in the things that are essential or necessary for consumers to do in life. But the balance tips toward the rights of parties to contract on their own for purely discretionary or optional recreational activities. That's how they strike the balance. And this bill reverses that balance, and it will void participation agreements in thousands of completely voluntary recreational relationships. The second point I just wanted to make is recreational activities are often more expensive to offer because they carry more risk than regular day-to-day activities. And so drawing the line at ordinary negligence claims allows providers to offer their activities at lower cost. For Lifetime, and I can speak just very briefly for Lifetime, I'm not an insurance expert, but I know it is true that it is very difficult for us to find insurance. We need to find a specialty insurer in order to actually insure our operations. We have pools with water slides, we have rock walls, we have kid programs. Those are risky endeavors. They carry significant risk. And so we have to pay a significant amount for insurance coverage as well as take a fairly significant premium just to keep our insurance costs in check. I would submit to you that insurers look to, obviously, the quality of the operation when they are issuing insurance. And so to the extent that Senator Sieben or any others would suggest that that somehow negligence waivers create an incentive for businesses to be negligent, they certainly do not. A business has to procure insurance. And when you operate with a large deductible, you end up focusing on safety so that you do not have to pay first dollar liability claims when they come in the door. Insurers will always ask, can you utilize a waiver of liability? And obviously, in almost all states throughout the country, you can. And in Minnesota, if this bill passes, we would have to answer that question no, and it would work into the underwriting criteria and the cost of insurance would go up. And the courts have generally said that that is not good, that the broad public interest is better served by allowing waivers so that the public at large can have access at a reasonable cost to a broad array of recreational services. That is the point. And this bill tips that balance, and I want to talk about the ways in which it does that. It essentially allows every creatively pled negligence claim to proceed against the operator probably all the way through trial, resulting in a large strain on operators as well as the courts. And here's how this works. There is a very fine line, and I would submit very little line between a negligent maintenance, operation, and design claim and inherent risk. So under the current law, here's how it works. The court reads the waiver, makes sure that it's clear, reads the waiver and compares it to the complaint that the plaintiff brought, the claim that the plaintiff asserts. And if the waiver clearly waives ordinary negligence claims and the plaintiff has brought an ordinary negligence claim, that claim can be dismissed. It's expedited. It happens as a question of law for the court. If this bill is passed, the operator will now have to defend ordinary negligence claims all the way through discovery and probably trial because no claims for negligent operation, maintenance, or design can be waived. And those are three very, very large categories. And Senator Sharon's concerns are exactly right in this way. The plaintiff's bar, I believe, will try to slot almost every type of conduct into one of those three categories, operation, maintenance, or design. And the carve-out for the injuries resulting from the inherent risk is already undefined, and it's very clear whether a court will actually weigh in on that as a matter of law. Plaintiff's bar will almost certainly argue that that is a fact question for the jury to be decided. And then the bill itself is silent with regard to the negligence of the participant himself or herself. It's completely silent. It only focuses on the negligence of the operator, and it doesn't talk about the comparative negligence of other participants in the activity. And so the operator is left to bear the cost to defend and face higher insurance costs over time, regardless of whether they were at fault, another participant was at fault, the plaintiff was at fault, or maybe nobody was at fault because it was an inherent risk. And so if we look at a few examples that have been discussed with this committee today, I think that could be illustrative. So one of them, Senator Sieben, talked a little bit about skiing, right? If you were to go out and go cross-country skiing on some groomed trails, you'd like to think that if you fall, that is an inherent risk. Falling while you're skiing is an inherent risk. I think we would all think that's true. But the plaintiff will say the person, when they hit a patch of ice, the claim will be that the operator of the ski hill negligently maintained the ski hill. And already there is actually a case in Minnesota where a ski hill, Powder Ridge, up in St. Cloud, was making snow, and the plaintiff hit a small bare patch, some grass where they hadn't gotten all the snow spread. You'd think that's an inherent risk of skiing. Instead, it was a negligent operation claim, a negligent maintenance claim. And right there, those are two ships that are going to pass in the night, and you'll be forced to defend all of those cases all the way through trial and potentially incur the expense to settle those cases rather than be able to argue inherent risk.
Okay, Mr. Linseth, I'm sorry I'm going to cut you off because you've taken up the 15 minutes of the 10 to 15 I allotted for everyone opposing. So unless the others don't want to say anything, perhaps we ought to give them an opportunity. I'm not saying what you're saying isn't valuable to listen to, but we don't have an hour and a half to hear on this one bill.
Fair enough, Mr. Chair. Could I make just one very final point?
Please.
The law right now in Minnesota does not leave consumers without recourse. Consumers can sue recreational operators even if they sign a waiver of liability. Waivers apply only to ordinary negligence. There are a number of concepts of greater than ordinary negligence, like gross negligence or wanton and willful negligence or reckless conduct or a conscious disregard of rights. And if a consumer could show that the operator met those standards, they would still be able to sue in those circumstances. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Linseth. Mr. McElroy?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association and the Minnesota Lodging Association. Let me make 3 points. I'm not an attorney, so I won't get as deeply into the woods as some others have. My members are small businesses. Most of them are literally mom-and-pop operations, particularly resorts and campgrounds. They do not have legal departments. They do not have large budgets for legal fees. This bill, somewhere between, concerns them deeply and scares them to death. Because of activities that are an important part of operating resorts and campgrounds and some types of lodging properties in Minnesota and competing with resorts, campgrounds, and lodging properties in surrounding states that wouldn't have this type of restriction on the ability to control insurance costs and risk costs. Some of the activities that my members offer and that make Minnesota a fun place to come for vacation may include renting boats and personal watercrafts and snowmobiles and all-terrain vehicles and bicycles and activities. The members I have that operate equestrian horse stables are extremely concerned about this because the distinction between a fault of operation, maintenance, or design may be one thing on a water park, maybe entirely a different thing on a horse. And if a horse malfunctions or misbehaves, we're very concerned about an equestrian operator being held liable for that, particularly under the laws under this system. Also operate beaches, pools, playgrounds, spas, golf courses, exercise rooms. Horseshoe pits are moderately dangerous, particularly if alcohol is involved and a horseshoe pin gets mistaken for a competitor's leg. Operating spas, sport courts, and a variety of other entities that are voluntary, but if resorts in Wisconsin and South Dakota and Iowa can have them, and the cost of insuring them in Minnesota is such that they're no longer possible or affordable, we're very concerned about our ability to compete for guests, and none of the states around us would operate with these restrictions. I have talked to the largest insurance markets for resort coverage. Resort coverage is hard to get. We're not big enough to access the markets that Mr. Linseth describes. The largest insurance agency has contacted the carriers that write resort insurance. They have all indicated that they will review their decision to offer coverage in Minnesota on some of those activities if this law is passed. Second issue we have a concern about is that in many cases we compete with local governments and state government in some of these activities. The largest operator of campgrounds is the Minnesota DNR. All of their activities would enjoy recreational immunity. Many cities have golf courses and swimming pools that are, to some extent, competition for golf courses and swimming pools or tennis courts operated by private companies. Government enjoys immunity. We do not. We're also deeply concerned about the effective date in this piece of legislation because the way it's written, it has the effect of allowing claims going back the length of the statute of limitations to be made under this new standard. And in some cases where our insurance is claims made rather than occurrence, we'd be left uninsured or at least with a dispute with our insurance company if an event happened 5 or 6 years ago and the terms of our insurance or of the liability have now changed on a claims made basis. I hope you won't go ahead with this bill, or if you do, you will amend it to make more clear that we can waive not only inherent risk but simple negligence. If you do elect to go ahead with it, I really believe the effective date should be changed 4 applies to cause of action commenced for events which occurred on or after the effective date. The way this is written, it could apply to events that occurred, I believe, up to 6 years ago.
Thank you, Mr. McElroy. Mr. Hines,
Mr. Chair, just so you're aware, I will offer an amendment when there. I do have an amendment to offer.
All right. Thank you. Let's also invite J.P. Augustine to come forward and Rob Smith to come forward, and then we'll have an opportunity for questions of all of those who have testified here as well. So, Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and member. For the record, I'm Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm also speaking on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association today. I won't repeat the previous testimony except to say that the League does agree with a number of the points made, in particular the problematic nature of the effective date. We also have concerns with what Mr. Linseth described as the distinction, the very fine distinction between simple negligence and inherent risk, and how that can lead to many claims that you might think would be excluded under the inherent risk statutory language. The municipal immunity was mentioned before, recreational facility immunity that municipalities in Minnesota do have. I would note that the bill is broader than recreational activity and will apply to any operation, maintenance, or design of the party's premises. So while for a city or a school district, recreational immunity may apply for a sporting event, it would not apply if a fire station had an event where neighborhood children came and were visiting the station. If a police station wanted to have some community event, this would prevent the city from having a liability waiver. I'll stop there. I know we're running short on time. Those are the primary concerns that we have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Are you Mr. Augustine? Welcome to the committee. And for those who, just a reminder, everyone who testifies, please sign in at the testifier sheet as well. Go ahead, Mr. Augustine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senators. My name is John P. Augustine. I am part of the ownership of Mount Cato Ski Area in Mankato, Minnesota, and also manager of Resort Process for Afton Alps Ski Area. Insurance is one of the main costs we have to account for from 1 year to the next when setting our prices, along with labor costs, electricity costs, fuel costs, miscellaneous supply costs. And there aren't usually, and we heard from the fitness industry, but it's even less, I think, in the ski industry. There aren't usually a lot of choices in the specialty insurance market, and frequently it might be two choices if we're lucky. Okay, so anything that's going to impact that insurance costs increased claims is going to impact the insurance costs and then pass on and probably increase in prices. And when the bill is talking that because skiing has inherent risk, that we shouldn't be so concerned. But there's always going to be this gray area, and that gray area is where you have the invitation to go to court or invitation to try to pursue a claim. Skiing has an inherent risk, but we do. Design and maintenance of our facilities and things that we have on the property of the ski area, we do various competitions. Okay, we have to have a signed waiver from all contest participants for racing programs, snowboard competitions, etc. Just this last weekend, we had a train park competition, rock and ride competition, where we gave out prizes. All the contestants had to sign a waiver. They were judged on degree of difficulty and style and so forth. Freestyle competition. We did a, if you know, you guys know what motocross is. We did a border cross where you know, banked. Snow bank terrain, you know, that we designed, and there's bumps and jumps and so forth. And not everybody who came to the premises had to do this. It was something they volunteered to do. They took on the extra risk, and so they were able to enjoy that competition. And from our hills, which are not, you know, gigantic mountains, A lot of people have risen to elite levels of competition here in the Midwest. I mean, you had Lindsey Vonn at Buck Hill. Ryan Paul is an elite, has competed in elite snowboard competitions. He started at Afton Alps. Monty Meyer has been to the Paralympics multiple times. He started at Afton Alps. And so we want to be able to offer that option, but it makes it much harder to do so if we're not able to shield ourselves from some of that extra liability risk. Anybody who goes snow tubing on our premises is supposed to sign a waiver. We would have to take a hard look whether to offer snow tubing at all, and then for some of the not offer some of the competitions. If we did continue some of the competitions, we'd probably have to add surcharges to offset some of the risk. We're talking about the governmental immunity, and just like the resorts and campgrounds, there are government-run recreational facilities and ski areas that wouldn't have that same. I mean, they'd also have problems with more people pursuing claims. You might get more into the caps, but again, anything that impacts liability on providers and businesses is going to further unbalance the playing field there between privately owned and managed operations recreational facilities and government-run recreational facilities, which won't have that same liability or responsibility. And so with that, I can answer questions if you like, but it's going to lead to more claims, and there's going to be real consequences to it. So,
thank you, Mr. Augustine. I have on the list here Rob Smith from the Construction Law Section of the MSBA. Mr. Smith?
Here, I'm Rob Smith, but I'm actually here to address the next bill.
I had a suspicion that might have been the case. All right, thank you. So are there any questions from members of the committee for any of those who just testified in opposition to the bill? All right, then is there any further testimony, Senator Sieben, you'd like to offer? I know Senator Ortman has an amendment.
Mr. Chair, at this time, I think it's just important to, again, point out that on line 1.8, it is talking about the party's premises, and so there is that distinction. And again, we've already talked about this, but there is language in here to talk that speaks specifically to the risk inherent in an activity. And it's the bill as proposed is drawing a distinction between waivers of liability for negligent conduct that results from the operation, maintenance, or design of the premise, and a distinction between that and the risk inherent in a particular activity. So one of the testifiers said that there would not be any need, or the assumption was there would no longer be waivers of liabilities, and I just don't think that that's an accurate statement. There still could be and would be, and we are just trying to bring some sense of fairness to consumers, understanding that not all of us are attorneys, myself included, when these waivers of liabilities are signed, that consumers need to understand that there is some inherent risk when they undertake an activity, but if there's negligence for the operation of that facility, again, like Representative Holberg said, if there are nails or bolts sticking out of a water slide and your child gets injured on that, you should not be waiving your right to damages by some slip of paper you sign. It just seems like that's too far.
All right. I was going to ask if there was anyone else in the room who wanted to testify. Mr. Augustine wanted to make an additional point. I think Mr. Carlson has something to add. Mr. Augustine.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Senator Leth. One thing I wanted to point out is we agree there still would be waivers, but then this whole concept of inherent risk versus the negligence is going to be a gray area. With the competitions, in any competition we hold, there's involves elements and changing weather conditions. The conditions and the risk to the participants can change during the course of the competition itself. So it's all, even though we're designing the, you know, helping to design the terrain and maintain the terrain, in the course of the competition itself, the conditions may change, may get more variable. Some feature might be impacted, and so the next person might have experienced a little more risk, and there's not much you can do about that in the course of a competition, and so it's just a risk that we ask if they want to have the competition, that we ask that they can sign that waiver, take on the extra risk, and it makes it possible to do it.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Seaton.
I just point out that Montana, which is a very popular ski state, has a similar provision that we're proposing here. Being a skier, I know that ski tickets in Montana are no higher than they are in other states, and they also offer similar competitions that are offered here. So I don't think that it's necessarily that if this would pass, it would assume that prices would automatically go up, or there would no longer be these competitions that are occurring here in Minnesota, because they're also right now occurring in Montana.
Mr. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sieben, you said that there would still be waivers, but as I look at the bill, I don't know how you can make that statement, at least for the purposes of negligence, when on line 8 it says that waivers that would arise out of for damage, waivers of liability for damages arising out of negligence are void and unenforceable. So how can you make that statement in light of the language before us?
Mr. Chair, Senator and Sieben. Senator Limmer, the waivers would only apply for the negligent operation, maintenance, or design of the party's premises. So everything else that's addressed in a typical waiver would still be able to be there and be enforceable by a court.
But, Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
There would be no more waiver for negligence, because that would be the public policy of the state, according to your bill, that it would be void and unenforceable.
Mr. Chair.
Other liabilities would be recognized, but not negligence.
Arising out of the premises, Senator Limmer.
I see.
That's the distinction Senator Sieben is drawing. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members. Briefly, Joel Carlson.
And then we'll do an amendment from Senator Orman.
I'm here on behalf of the Association for Justice, just very briefly, and I want to, before she leaves, I want to address Senator Sharon's question about case filings, but Mr. Chairman and members, we do support this bill, and we just want you to know that there is not runaway litigation in Minnesota. Civil court filings are down over 40% in the injury area in Minnesota in the last 10 years. There's no rush to the courthouse in this state, and we've got about 1,000 members, and if you think insurance companies are paying a claim that is not with merit, they would be surprised. This idea that we're just paying a claim to get rid of it when they don't have liability, they just don't pay. But a couple things that I just wanted to mention from the testimony, and one of the issues is, you know, these three states that prohibit them. There are at least 20 others that through case law do not enforce these kinds of waivers of negligence against a consumer. And there are a few like Minnesota where it's kind of in the bubble. It may be in or maybe out. But the issues that they talk about, you know, are really not the ones like going to the library, or you're not signing an agreement. If you go to the firehouse, you're not having a written agreement for the activity. This would not apply. What this applies to are the inherent risks of the activity, and those are fine, and we assume those, and we have, and this doesn't change at all. The only thing that this applies to is when the premises does something negligent that causes an injury. And I represent a lot of business people, and I've talked with them about this bill. And when I say, when you negligently injure your patron or your guest, are you really saying that you don't want to be responsible for that? And to a person, no one says that. They want to be responsible, and they are responsible. This just brings the law to a place where you have a claim when only their negligence, which applies to all of us, Senator Limmer. That's the standard that we have in this state for all of our activities, is a reasonable standard of care. All this does is apply that in a reasonable way. And we don't in any way want to undo the current protections for the inherent risk of the activity. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think we maybe have some other comments on the amendment when you get to that.
Okay, well, let's deal with that right now. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A good lawyer can almost always associate any injury with the premises, the operation of the equipment. Almost always. It would be very hard. I mean, very easy to do that. I think we want to continue to have waivers of liability. But I can see that there's a place for some clarification. And so that's why I would offer the 323 amendment. Mr. Chair, it was drafted in the revisor's office. And what it does is it clarifies. It takes out that reference to negligent operation, maintenance, or design, but clarifies that a person that is signing a waiver is only doing it for negligent acts, and so an act that was greater than ordinary negligence would still be actionable at law. And that's what the 323 does, and it also addresses that concern that was raised about the difference between the timing of the lawsuit when it is commenced or when the cause of action is accrued.
But, the amendment is being distributed. Senator Sieben, do you have it yet?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Okay. I would ask Mr. Carlson to respond.
Mr. Carlson to Senator Ortman's proposed amendment 323.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We don't see what we appreciate Senator Ortman's effort, but we do see an inconsistency with how other areas of negligent waivers are addressed, whether it's truckers, construction, the inflatable devices of Senator Sieben's. You know, we are creating a different standard here. But what the standard that you're creating then that isn't ordinary negligence, which is reasonable care, is then something higher, which is gross negligence, reckless, or willful conduct, which is the status of the law right now. So I think the language that you've suggested pretty much eliminates the need for the bill, because you are saying that those higher levels of negligence, which are currently recognized, would be the standard. And just so the committee knows, you know, gross negligence in Minnesota is no care at all. And so we would have concern saying that the standard of care for a premises, which is not reasonable care or ordinary negligence in maintaining their facility, is gross negligence, which in Minnesota law is no care at all.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I believe it's good public policy to allow people to waive negligence, a claim for negligence. I believe that's good public policy. I think the Minnesota Supreme Court has said that. And what I'm saying is beyond that, we don't want, I believe Senator Sieben is saying, we don't want people to be waiving anything beyond negligence. And I think that this amendment accomplishes that. But, Mr. Chair, I hope that you would allow Mr. Linseth to testify about the application of the amendment.
Mr. Linseth, do you wish to testify on?
Mr. Chairman, while he's coming
Mr.
up,
Carlson.
Senator Ortman, I don't think
Mr.
I've read
Linseth,
one.
Come forward.
I don't think I've read one of the cases where the courts have said this is good public policy. They have said, rather, that we disfavor these contracts of adhesion, but if they meet these certain conditions, we will uphold them. I don't think I've read one that said it's good public policy for the state to enforce them, but they will enforce them.
Senator Ortman, I just read, scanned anyway, the Schlobohm decision by the Supreme Court. And aside the fact that it's curious, they list four dissenting justices out of seven members. That's a little odd. So there must have been some error in what was reported. Mr. Friegel can explain that.
There were nine justices at that time in 1982.
Nine, yeah. Well, that would explain it. So it was a 5-4 decision, not exactly a ringing decision in terms of unanimity or anything. They were Justices Simonette, Yetka, Wall, and Todd. Dissented, but the conclusion was that the waiver was not void as against public policy, which is a little bit different than saying it was a favorable public policy that they were endorsing. But be that as it may, and Mr. Linseth, and I'll ask Mr. Carlson also if you have positions on line 8 of the amendment as a separate matter relating to the effective date and accrual versus commencement of the claim. Mr. Linseth?
Speak to that.
You want to speak to the effective date now, Mr. Chairman?
Sure, Mr. Carlson, go ahead. Pull the mic over so we can hear.
Sure. Mr. Chairman and members, the effective date in Senator Stevens' bill is one that we support. It's one that the legislature commonly uses. It's similar language to Senator Ortman's bill, where it was effective immediately following final enactment for anything that's in place at that time. This just simply says on commencement of the action that you may have an injury right now that has not been litigated, that this new law would take effect. And there was a case, I believe it was called Goldman versus Northland Physicians, where the court said that this is an appropriate legislative tool to address a policy for claims that have not yet been filed in court. And so we don't want to arm wrestle over commenced over accrued, but the language in the bill is specific, and we've used it many times in this legislature.
All right, Mr. Linseth.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on the commenced versus accrued point, when you use the notion of commenced, it might relate to an injury that happened several years ago, certainly an injury that occurred within the statute of limitations, as well as an injury that would be subject to a waiver that will have been signed in the past. And it seems to me if this body is going to change the law in Minnesota in such a dramatic way, it ought to do so only on a prospective basis as opposed to a retroactive basis. With respect to the other items in Senator Ortman's amendment, the inclusion of the for participation in voluntary recreational activities language is some clarifying language to make it mirror the common law standard that suggests that it applies only for voluntary recreational activities. It speaks a little bit to the point that the city raised, and also the notion that the bill as drafted might apply in even a business-to-business context, you know, with regard to a lease or some other business transaction. So it focuses on what seems to be the author's concern. And then the second piece that addresses waivers for conduct that is greater than ordinary negligence. Mr. Carlson suggests that the law is well settled on that. I'm not so sure that it is. There is a Minnesota Supreme Court decision that the chair has cited, the Schlobohm decision, that makes clear that you cannot waive liability for wanton and willful conduct or wanton and willful negligence. But the law is not settled on gross negligence. There's no Minnesota Supreme Court decision yet. There is a Court of Appeals decision in Minnesota that says you cannot waive greater than ordinary negligence. And so this would solidify or codify that notion as well. And I don't know of any decisions out there that really address sort of the reckless standard or other potential types of conduct that would be above ordinary negligence. So that's what that aims to do. And then we already addressed the accrued versus commenced point.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Mr. Carlson can answer this, but our counsel can. I'm wondering, first of all, I want to just say that I know somebody can sue us, homeowners, if their child, for example, gets hurt on our playground equipment.
Correct.
Or if somebody falls and gets hurt in our home, trips over something that shouldn't have been there, whatever. My question is, in statutes, do they have to prove more than ordinary negligence in order to make that lawsuit against a homeowner?
Mr. Carlson, and then we're going to bring the amendment to a vote.
The Mr. Chairman and Mr. Flegel is much more qualified than I to answer, but the answer is only if you're negligent. That's the standard. That's what applies to you as a homeowner. That's how you're supposed to maintain your property. That's what applies to you. This would apply that to places where we are paying fees to go that they don't negligently injure us. And that is what the bill is asking to accomplish.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
And also if our dog gets loose and bites the next door neighbor, we can be sued for that. And my point here is that if us as individual homeowners can get sued for what may be considered negligent behavior, why wouldn't we apply that same standard? I mean, that's my support for the bill, is we would want to apply that same standard to others if it's applied to us as individuals, in my opinion.
Mr. Flegel, you have something to add?
Mr. Chair, just very briefly, if I may, to the amendment, specifically with regard to lines 1-5 and 1-6 addressing, a change to a conduct that constitutes greater than ordinary negligence. I wanted to just kind of help you with that concept, if I might. That is a fairly well-defined concept in law, more in employment-related work injury cases. There are a number of decisions there, the most recent of which from the Minnesota Supreme Court, I believe, is from 2010, involving Corey Stringer's death, Stringer versus Minnesota Vikings, that ruled, for example, that the concepts of recklessness, gross negligence, are the lack of even scant care. So if the defendant were to respond and say, I furnished you scant care, that would not meet the definition. It has to be less than that in order to qualify for recklessness or gross negligence. That's why I believe Mr. Carlson equates it with the lack of any care, if it's less than scant care. So if were the amendment adopted, it would essentially have the effect of barring any claims by injured consumers.
All right. Mr.
Chair.
Mr. Lunseth, is it anything new?
Well, it's just very briefly. It's not fair to say that it would bar all claims. Those are somewhat higher standards, it is true. But there is also a standard of wanton and willful negligence.
Mr. Lunseth, we already know that this bill is not addressing those kinds of claims.
The amendment seeks to allow those claims to advance, and you actually can advance that claim if you discover a person in a position of peril and you fail to use ordinary care to take the person out of that position. Right. And it might well address Senator Sieben's example of the obvious bolt coming out of the water slide. So it does not require something, a showing of grosser than ordinary negligent in order to advance a wanton and willful negligence claim.
All right. We're going to take a vote on the amendment. Now,
Mr. Chair,
Senator Ortman,
if I could just speak to the amendment, whether you believe that it's good public policy or not, it has been the public policy of the state of Minnesota to allow these waivers of liability in the recreational activity industries, and we have industries that have grown up around it. We have Lifetime Fitness that's nationally renowned. We have others as well, and so we have probably thousands of businesses that rely on this practice. And I think it's a very big departure from what is current practice and common law and what's been established in our courts of law. And I would hate to see us do this without very clearly explaining what we are doing. And I think that the 323 amendment clarifies the intention here, makes a slight adjustment, but moves forward without devastating current practices. And I would ask for member support and a roll call vote.
All right. There's been a roll call requested, and Senator Ortman, the public policy of this state has been established by the Supreme Court in terms of just a pure legal analysis. The legislature is now being asked to take a position on this, just like they did on your bill last year, creating an exemption from the Supreme Court's rules as these apply. And so the question will be before this committee now on the 323 amendment. Senator Ortman moves the adoption of the 323 amendment. There's been a roll call requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Latz.
No.
Hall.
Yes.
Ortman.
Yes.
Cohen.
No.
Limmer.
Yes.
Goodwin.
No.
Sharon.
Yes.
Dietzick.
No.
There being four in favor and four against, the amendment does not prevail. Is there any further discussion that's not redundant on the underlying bill itself, Senate File 768?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
You had to put that qualifier in, didn't you?
I did, because we have other bills to get to today.
I would like to make a verbal amendment, oral amendment, and on line 15 of page 1, change the word commence to accrued. I believe the way the bill is written now, this would be retroactive provision, and we rarely, if ever, write anything retroactive. It's an example. We would have to find an example of a very extreme situation to justify a retroactivity, and I believe we should at least, if this bill does pass, that it should have the accrued language in it rather than anything else.
Mr. Chair.
Who said that? Senator Seaman.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to accept that as a friendly amendment if Senator Limmer would then vote for the bill.
It's not that friendly.
There's always conditions.
Yes, and I'll note Senator Ortman's bill from last year, Senate File 1687, did by its own terms apply to existing contracts on the effective date. So apparently Senator Ortman's bill was retroactive in the same manner that Senator Seaman's bill proposes to be.
Mr. Chair, they aren't even comparable bills that related to motor carriers. Just not even comparable.
All right, Mr. Carlson, and then we've already had lots
Chairman,
of testimony on accrual.
We've had several good conversations with Mr. Lindstedt, and we're happy to continue those as well. I don't think that that we want to arm wrestle over commenced or accrued right here. It's different in the House bill. We're going to have further discussions on this, and we're happy to continue to have
Senator
discussions
Seaman,
on
are you
that
accepting
point.
This as a friendly amendment?
Yes.
All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the bill. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that Senate File 768 as amended be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Roll call, please.
There being a roll call requested, there will be a roll call. Clerk will take the roll.
Latz.
Yes.
Ortman.
No.
Hall.
No.
Limmer.
No.
Cohen.
Yes.
Goodwin.
Yes.
Sharon.
No.
Dietzick.
Yes.
Now, there being four in favor and four against, the bill does not pass. The motion does not prevail. That concludes our hearing on Senate File 768.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members.
Procedurally, here's what we're going to do. For those of you who are waiting for Senate File 388, we will not have time to hear that this afternoon. I'm sorry. We are going to proceed with Senator Jensen's bill, Senate File 561. Senate File 388, Senator Carlson's bill, will be rescheduled probably to Thursday, I would expect. You got Thursday?
Oh, I'm sorry.
388?
Thursday.
Thursday evening. We're starting at 6 p.m. All right, Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And for
and
everyone
committee.
Who's testifying on this bill, brevity and conciseness will be appreciated.
Okay, got it. Thank you. Thank you for hearing Senate File 561. I do have an amendment. A one amendment.
Being passed out, members. Senator Jensen, this is your first committee on this bill, so this
That's
is
correct.
Considered an author's amendment. Senator Goodwin moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Jensen, please describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill relates to Chapter 337 under Building and Construction Contracts. In 1984, we've heard a little bit about this already today, but the Minnesota legislature adopted the anti-indemnification statute 337.02. That law prohibits agreements where one person agrees to be responsible for injuries or damages caused by another. People must only answer for injuries or damages that they themselves cause. We're not changing that section of the statute. At the same time, the anti-indemnification statute does permit agreements in construction contracts where one person agrees to purchase insurance for the benefit of others. That's 337.05, and that's what we're dealing with today. If one person purchases the specified insurance covering another's losses, then that insurer bears that loss. Basically, you can't agree to indemnify someone for their negligence, but you can purchase insurance for them, and that creates an insurance exception. General contractors in the construction industry have been developing and testing indemnification language in their contracts and agreements with the intent for transferring the liability for the general contractor's own negligence onto subcontractors. Frequently, these provisions require subcontractors to not only indemnify the general contractor for damages caused by defective or substandard workmanship, but also to indemnify the general contractor for the general contractor's own negligence. Now, virtually all new construction contracts require some type of broad form indemnification. This insurance exception does not work and ultimately forces costs to the subcontractors. Subcontractors absolutely accept responsibility for their actions and their work, but the exception has created a disparity in bargaining power between contractors and subcontractors. If you don't sign the contract that the general contractor is offering and take on those extra risks and the extra costs, you won't get the work. The system forces the risk down to the level least able to afford it. Because most insurance policies look at loss history for 5 years, that extra cost lingers years after the incident, even when the subcontractor is found to be not at fault. Ultimately, the party doing the least work is financially liable for the most risk and risk that they do not control. There are more than 15 trade associations that support this bill. The Minnesota Trial Lawyers support the bill. The Insurance Federation is neutral on this bill, and there should be a copy of a letter that I received from them that you should have, I think. They'll be able to answer some questions, too. That's basically what we're talking about today. I do have some testifiers with me, and I would like Kurt Smith to go ahead and testify, if that's all right with the committee.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Smith. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kurt Smith. I'm the chapter attorney for the MSA, or the Minnesota Subcontractors Association. We are one of, I believe, 18 specialty trade organizations that are supporting and sponsoring this bill. MSA has over 120 members who are subcontractors and associated businesses providing services to subcontractors. Senator Jensen has outlined very clearly what the purpose of this bill is, and I don't intend to repeat that given the desire to limit time, which is always hard for a lawyer to do, but nonetheless, I'll do my best. The issue here is the insurance loophole to the anti-indemnity statute. As Senator Jensen said, this legislature decided a long time ago it was bad public policy for me to enter into an agreement to indemnify you for your wrongful acts. And the insurance loophole that we're trying to close here has just been used as that. What they can't do from the front door through an indemnity clause is being done through the back door of the insurance requirement. And the insurance requirement that we're seeking to have prohibited in this bill is one where I, as a subcontractor, am being required by contract to purchase insurance to protect you, most cases a general contractor, or sometimes even an owner or a design professional, for your own independent acts of negligence. We are not, and I want to repeat, we are not trying to avoid having to name general contractors or owners as additional insureds on our policy to cover their potential vicarious liability for our wrongful acts. That is not what we're seeking to do here. That is not what this bill does. But it does prohibit, and we're seeking to have it prohibited, us being forced by contract to insure your negligent acts. This is good public policy. It supports the anti-indemnity statute, which this legislature has already decided is good public policy. There's been a number of objections raised to this bill, and I just want to address a couple of them because, quite honestly, I think they're red herrings and trying to divert from the real purpose of what we're doing here. First, there's been an assertion, and I expect we'll hear from some of the folks who are testifying against the bill, that if this bill is passed, it will prohibit or at least adversely affect builders' risk insurance, workers' comp insurance. We're getting into some inside baseball and insurance stuff here, I know, but OSIPs, what are CSIPs, project policies, that is, specialty policies that are developed for projects themselves. We believe that is totally incorrect. Number one, and perhaps foremost, if you look at MnStat 337.04, which is not being affected, is an existing statute, part of the Anti-Indemnity Act, it specifically says that the provisions do not affect the validity of insurance contracts, and then goes on to name workers' comp, et cetera. Those insurance products are not regulated or the terms of those by this bill. What is being regulated is a very narrow contractual provision that requires one party to buy insurance to liability insurance to protect another from his or her own negligence. We believe that the experience in other states, and there's a number of other states that have adopted similar, if not the same, legislation, that is anti-indemnity statutes coupled with a prohibition on buying insurance to protect one against one's own negligence. And what we've been told is that, in fact, in those areas, there have been more OSIPs, CSIPs, project policies, wrap-ups on construction projects, specifically large construction projects, because it avoids the whole issue of indemnity. When you have a wrap-up or a project insurance policy that covers all the participants in a construction project, the Twin Stadium that was built, the Viking Stadium to be built, undoubtedly will be insured in this manner. The issue of indemnity of one subcontractor versus another versus a general is irrelevant because one insurance policy will cover and pay for the liability to the injured person, say it's a worker or somebody else, who is injured and has a right to bring a claim under that policy. In fact, it will facilitate getting these things done better in our view.
Mr. Smith, I'm going to encourage you to wrap up your comments, please.
I'll wrap up very quickly.
I'll say we have to have this bill dealt with this afternoon, and we got about 15 or 20 minutes left in the
okay.
hearing.
Okay, I'm sorry, and I'll leave it there. The last comment I'll make is you'll probably also hear that for 30 years, the situation in the construction industry has been the way it is, what we're trying to change, the ability to use these contractual provisions to require somebody to buy insurance. And I'll tell you that for 30 years, this has worked just fine. And I'm here to tell you that it's worked just fine for the folks at the top of the pyramid, the general contractors. It has not worked fine for the subcontractors who are bearing the financial cost of others' negligence, and that's what we're trying to stop. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Senator Goodwin.
I have a question here. I think this is a good bill. I just want to make sure that the homeowner or the owner of the building, especially the homeowner, will be protected, because currently if there's a problem with the home that's built, they can't get the builder or the general contractor to make the repairs or the subcontractors, so then they have the option of, you know, going to mediation or going to court or whatever to get that done. What happens right now with the homeowners, they end up having their attorney against 8 or 9 or however many attorneys, the window attorney, the roof attorney, the insurance industry attorney, and the homeowner almost never gets the money they need to just repair the problems. So I just want to make sure that And that the homeowner doesn't have to prove who is at fault, because sometimes it can be a bad roof job along with window flashing not inserted properly. So it can be more than one contractor that's responsible for the problems. I like the idea that they may only have one or two of the general contractors or the subcontractor's attorney there, so the homeowner isn't so overwhelmed. But also I want to make sure that the homeowner is going to be protected in this case by being able to make sure they can still, they don't have to prove who is at fault, that they can just go to the general contractor and then they can figure out who is at fault, and then that subcontractor can be, can still be sued.
Mr. Smith, could you address that briefly, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin. This bill does not address the homeowners' rights under the estate statutory warranties, which I think is what you're mm-hmm. referring to in the construction of a new home or a remodeling project. And in fact, you're right that as a matter of statutory warranty law and contract law, the homeowner has a claim against that general contractor with whom or who the homeowner hired to do the work. The general contractor may try to spread that loss among responsible subcontractors. We are dealing with the spreading of that loss. We want to be sure in that the law says that those who are responsible should pay their fair share. But if I'm not responsible, I shouldn't have to pay your share in this below the pyramid. It doesn't really change what the homeowner does, because the homeowner in all likelihood is just going to sue that general contractor. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does, and I think it's the right answer for my concern. I also want to make sure that all the subcontractors will still have to purchase their own liability insurance for their own liability in such a case.
Mr. Smith.
Yes. All prudent subcontractors will buy insurance. It will not affect the obligation, both contractual and common sense, for a subcontractor, a business person, to buy insurance to protect against his or her own fault. Okay. But that's all we want to ensure, our own fault, not somebody else's.
Thank you.
We have a number of people who have signed up to testify against the bill. So I'm going to ask them to come forward now. We have Doug Speedling, Bill Straczynski, Gary Thaden, if I pronounced that correctly. And then I also have Al Gerhart, Patrick Hines, and Brian Sweeney. Mr. Smith, you're also the other Mr. Smith, Rob Smith. All right, so let's try to be concise if we might, please. Thank you.
I'll be brief.
We've got 15 minutes left to hear the bill.
I'll be brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Speedling. I'm a carpenter contractor from Hastings, Minnesota. I employ 40 carpenters currently. I've been in business since 1979. Our work is to supply labor, follow the plans, the specs, and directions of the general contractor. In the past 2 years, I've been brought into 7 of these claims where I've done nothing wrong. Each claim cost my company $1,000 in deductible, cost our time and energy tracking these, cost my insurance company, I'm told, $8,000 to $15,000 to defend. One of these claims, I was deposed for 5 hours with 7 attorneys present. Remember, I've done nothing wrong. As these cases are brought to me, I read them. I state that we've done nothing wrong. I ask my insurance company to get us out of these claims. Their concern is I've signed a broad form indemnity clause. Contract with a broad form indemnity contract. If I do not sign these contracts, I don't get work. Every general contractor out there has them on their contracts. When I bring up the issue, because this has been going on for a couple of years, immediately I get flagged, and I might as well put closed due to not signing broad form indemnity contracts. People do not believe when I say that I have nothing wrong. I tell them to come in my office and read the complaints and see if you see anything in these complaints that relate to carpenter labor. They also don't believe that I can be held responsible for other people's mistakes. I remember I sat through 5 hours of depositions. Currently, I'm going to get work. I have to sign these contracts with broad form indemnity clauses. I'm held responsible for others' mistakes. If I don't sign these contracts, I don't get work. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Speedling.
My name is Gary Thaden. I'm here on behalf of Bill Straczynski and the Minnesota Electrical Contractors Association, the Minnesota Contractors of the National Electrical Contractors Association, and the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association. We think this is a great bill, and you should vote yes on it. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Gerhart, Al Gerhart. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee. My name is Al Gerhart. I'm Chief Operating Officer for Krauss Anderson Construction. I've been with Krauss Anderson for 32 years. I'm preparing my testimony for today. I talked to several of our general contractor peers in the industry, and I've yet to find one who has supported Senate File 561. We're headquartered in Minneapolis. I've been in business for 116 years in a Minnesota corporation. We negotiate more than 300 owner contracts a year and over 3,500 subcontracts. Excuse me. In the construction industry, it's inherent that there are challenges with quality and safety, and we do our best to manage these risks, and we have a very high standard for safety and have been recognized by the Governor's Award of Excellence for our safety record. For the last 30 years, the construction industry in Minnesota, including project owners, design professionals, general contractors, and subcontractors, has successfully completed construction projects in the state in a system that allows for an effective and efficient allocation of risk associated with the construction work. A system where the project owner requires the general contractor to indemnify and name the owner as an additional insured under our owner contract for claims that arise out of the work that we manage as a general contractor. In turn, we require each subcontractor to indemnify and name the general contractor as an additional insured in the subcontract for claims arising out of their work. In most cases, general contractor's liability is vicarious liability, since general contractors typically do not perform work. That's very typical for us. Over 90% of the work on a job site is performed by subcontractors. Similarly, subcontractors may use a similar provision and ask their subcontractors to indemnify and name them as additional insured. The effect of this arrangement is the parties who are actually performing the work, that being the subcontractor, is in the best position to guard against the risk and is the one who's charged with the responsibility of insuring against a claim arising out of that subcontractor's work. Getting one subcontractor or one insurer to cover this risk is the most efficient and cost-effective means and is good public policy. Senate File 561, as currently drafted, has several consequences that have a negative material impact on the industry. Number one, the bill as currently drafted prohibits the owner under the owner-contractor agreement to obligate the general contractor to buy builder's risk policies for a project, policies that insure for fire, flood, and other risks for both for all the parties, the owner, subcontractor, and subs, and general contractors, causing each subcontractor, therefore, in that case, to buy that insurance separately, causing the cost of construction to go up. Similarly, the bill, as currently drafted, would prohibit owners or contractors from using owner-controlled insurance programs or contractor-controlled insurance programs because it's the most cost-effective system. It's routinely used on large projects. An example of this on the Minnesota People Stadium project is contemplating using owner-controlled insurance program, again, because it's the most cost-effective way. This will cause the cost of construction to go up on those projects where these tools are no longer available. I'm here today to tell you that the current contract indemnity statute is fair and that all parties, owners, design professionals, general contractors, and subs, all understand the indemnity insurance principles. Insurance is readily available in the marketplace for all subcontractors who are in good standing and have a quality safety and good quality and safety program. The indemnity insurance principles provide us with an effective means to price the cost of allocating or accepting the risk through insurance, and the cost of this is charged to the project as part of their bid. We are not strong-arming subcontractors to accept some unreasonable standards. All they simply need to do is say no. If they don't like the risk on a particular project, there are other subcontractors who understand the risk and are prepared to accept it and price it into their bid. Just like we do with owners, when we find a project that is too risky, we just say no. We are all professional business people. We are on equal bargaining positions, and we understand the inherent risk associated with construction contracts and their risk allocation. Further, insurers in the construction industry understand these indemnity principles, and they price their insurance products based on allocation of indemnity and insurance responsibility and collect premiums based on their assessment of the risk. The current indemnity model has served the industry well for over 30 years. The system is not broken. It continues to serve the industry well. The legislature got it right when they established the current statute. It is the most cost-effective and efficient means to manage the risk. Changing the system will confuse the market, increase the cost of construction, requiring multiple parties to ensure the same risk on a project and increasing litigation cost. For the good of the industry, for the good of the public policy, this bill should not be passed. If for some reason you think that the current statute needs to change, we would support having the Minnesota Bar Association take the lead through its legislative subcommittee in discussing reforms with all interested parties in an effort to find common ground. Thank you.
Mr. Gerhardt, I have a question for you. You said that your current contracts provide that the subcontractor should have insurance to cover the general contractor's vicarious liability for the subcontractor's negligence.
That should be for the general contractor's negligence.
For the general contract? So the general contractor is having the subcontractor insure against the general contractor's negligence?
For their vicarious liability. We ask our subcontractors to name us as additional insured on their policy for our liability associated with a claim that would arise out of their work.
Out of their work?
Right.
But what about claims that arise out of the general contractor's work?
No.
Well, it looks like the bill, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it looks like the bill is prohibiting insurance for the negligence or intentional acts or omissions of third parties. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like you're already in, it sounds like you support that. I mean, the current practice seems to be different.
I think the bill is too broad. I think the bill, we would support a Bar Association amendment to the bill, which would limit it to sole negligence. That would be, if the general contractor was solely negligent, we would be fine with that exclusion from being allowed under the indemnity provision.
What if the general contractor was jointly negligent? The general contractor did something that was negligent,
right,
either alone or in concert with the sub. Why should the subcontractor buy insurance to protect the general contractor against the general contractor's negligence?
In many cases, just by association on a project, a general contractor will have some minor percent of negligence. It may be very minor, but the most cost-effective way to insure against that is not have multiple parties buying insurance for the same claim or the same risk. We have assigned that risk to a subcontractor to buy the insurance for themselves and name us as additional insured if we have risk associated with that claim or negligence associated with that claim.
I'm just having trouble following this because you said that It's important to have the insurance paid for by the party that's in a position to prevent the harm, which in principle I agree with you. But how does shifting the cost onto the subcontractor help when it's the general contractor that's in a position to prevent the general contractor's own bad acts?
Well, I think we certainly have an obligation to affect our negligence, but we're not the ones performing the work. The majority of the time, the subcontractor is the one performing the work. And so we understand that there may be cases where we may have some limited amount of negligence. I think our approach to this is to identify one insurance company and one group to purchase insurance in a cost-effective way to manage that claim. It brings the parties together to focus on a solution versus having the parties get entrenched, all hire separate attorneys, all have separate insurance companies, all trying to defend themselves versus looking for a solution.
Sounds to me, with all due respect, it sounds like it's just cost shifting down onto the subcontractors. And maybe the general contractor should find insurance for the entire project, including all the subcontractors. Then you'd have the single point to purchase, and you'd achieve those efficiencies without shifting the costs onto the subcontractors to protect against the general contractor's own negligence.
And we have programs like this, which this bill would actually prohibit us from using. It's called a contractor-controlled insurance program, which we would support. The bill as drafted would not allow that to be used because it would mean that in our contract between us and our subcontractors, we would assign the responsibility for risk from one party to another, in that particular case, from a subcontractor to the contractor. And we're okay with that, and we would look to use those tools. This particular language would prohibit us from doing that.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Senator Dietzick?
Well, I was going to ask if Senate counsel could clarify that, because I've heard conflicting viewpoints on that type of policy. So I don't know if Ms. Pontius can address that at all. Would this cover those?
Ms.
Pontius.
Chairman, Senator Dietzick, I'm literally writing down the acronym right now because
okay.
I didn't know what it stood for. So I'm just learning myself here. So.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gerhardt. Patrick Hines and Brian Sweeney have signed up to testify as well. And then Rob Smith. Why don't you come on forward as well, Mr. Smith? Mr. Hines, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. The conversation thus far is focused on the contractual relationship between general contractor and subcontractor. But the bill language also implicates the contractual relationship between the owner and the general contractor, and that's what I would like to discuss. Right now, a city is owner of a construction project. They enter into a contract with the general contractor. They hire the general for their experience in running and managing these contracts. And we think it is appropriate for the general contractor to indemnify the owner. The owner is not on the project. It's not supervising the project. Nonetheless, the negligence claims can be made against the owner. And because the general is in charge of the contract, it's standard practice, and we believe that practice should continue, that the general will indemnify the owner, even if there's a negligence claim against the owner.
Mr. Hines, if the owner is negligent, however, you would still want that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yes, that's the current practice now. And a negligence claim against the owner is oftentimes thrown in because there may be other insurance that can be had. An owner hires the general to run the project and to make sure that it runs smoothly. And the owner's not on this on-site. They're not participating in the work. They're not inspecting. This is really the general's job. And status quo today is that the general contractor will procure and maintain that insurance. I don't believe there's a disparity in bargaining position between city as an owner and the general contractor. These projects are publicly bid. The insurance requirements are well known by all contractors, and any costs can be incorporated into their bid. And what we would like is for there to be an exception for prime contracts between political subdivisions and general contractors. We've discussed this issue with Senator Jensen. She's graciously agreed to consider our proposal and has agreed to work with us as this bill goes through the process. And we greatly appreciate that and hope we can reach an agreement that will lead to peace in the valley, for lack
Senator
of a
Johnson.
Better term.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing I'd like the committee to keep in mind is that what we're talking about, the insurance already exists for all of the people that are involved, the owner, the general, and the sub. What we're talking about is which insurer is going to be responsible for paying any claims that come up. That's what happens with the loophole. And with this testimony, you can see where the pyramid gets even bigger, where now the owner's indemnity is passed to the general, and then the general, if he's passing it on to the sub is also taking on the owners by the way that those contracts from the general to the sub. So this gets even bigger. And what happens then is when there's a claim, when you get a claim as a subcontractor, that stays on your record for loss history for up to 5 years, whether you're at fault or not for all of that. I am willing, and we met today. I've had several groups come to me today and express the concerns with the CIP and some of the owner to general contractor. I am willing to meet with them and discuss, but I like this bill. I agree with this bill. I think it needs to move forward the way that we have it, and but I am willing to talk about that language. But I like the bill the way it is, and I would like for it to move forward.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Sweeney?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Sweeney. I'm with BNSF Railway in St. Paul. We also have concerns with this bill as drafted. While we're not part of the general contractor, subcontractor dispute that's going on, we have the problem of liability exposure being thrust upon us by other people. The problem begins with nobody has insurance for doing construction work anywhere near a railroad track. The general liability policies do not cover work within 50 feet of a railroad track. That's a hole that has to be filled with what is known as railroad protective insurance. So right now, not only aren't they insured for someone else's liability, they aren't even insured for their own, unless they get railroad protective insurance. Standard policy across the country, in fact, the Federal Highway Administration rules specifically allow for it, describe it, and get into the funding limits for FHWA projects. We have a number of projects that are taking place on or near our property and that the insurance industry has recognized as inherently hazardous enough that it's not normally insured. Special insurance is required. That insurance does include provisions covering railroad negligence, short of things such as sole negligence or something that happens under the direction of a railroad person. But this would invalidate those projects. So we have a situation such as City of Minneapolis wants to replace the St. Anthony Bridge over our yard in Minneapolis. They're going to be constructing bridge supports in the middle of a busy rail yard that handles several trains a day, thousands of cars traveling through, all kinds of other equipment, but we won't be able to have insurance against operating as a railroad in that situation. There's nothing in it for us, but we get all this liability exposure without any ability to be protected from a negligence claim. The Twin Stadium was mentioned earlier. Part of that is constructed over railroad right-of-way, which was operating as a railroad, of course, during the construction phase. We had to have protection for that. We had to have protection for the construction of the North Star facilities. If the Northern Lights Express gets funding, there will be certainly a number of these concerns with that project as well. We have municipalities and private enterprises who lease property from us. Something as simple as a municipality repaving a parking lot on land they rent from us adjacent to our tracks. There's no insurance in place for that. If we operate as a railroad, we have a liability exposure for somebody else's construction activities. So for that reason, I would ask that provision be adopted comparable to one that Missouri and a few other states have adopted, where they exclude railroads that are regulated by the Federal Railroad Administration. As I said, the justification is a real anomaly in insurance law and in what's available on the insurance market. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'll try to be very brief. My name is Rob Smith. I am this year's chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association Construction Section. That's a group that's made up of construction lawyers from throughout the state. Our members represent owners, general contractors, subcontractors, architects, and engineers. We met 11 days ago to discuss this bill as well as the others that have been floating around to amend the anti-indemnification statute. And with respect to this bill in particular and some of the other bills, the overwhelming consensus among the construction bar was that, and I'll limit my comments to this bill for now, the overwhelming consensus was that this bill is ripe with unintended consequences that far outweigh the alleged problem that the bills are intended to address. The vote was 35-3. So you have basically a supermajority of construction lawyers saying this really needs to be rethought out. And so what the Bar Association has proposed is that they are willing to sit down and act as a mediator, if you will, with all of the parties. What you've got here is a dispute, frankly, between the MSA, the subcontractors, and the AGC, the general contractors. What we've proposed is everybody should slow down. The Bar Association would be happy to meet with those groups and try to work out a compromise. Frankly, that may not be possible, but hopefully, if we did that, what you would have in front of you would be competing bills, potentially, but they wouldn't have these unintended consequences. And I know Mr. Smith, the other Mr. Smith, has said, well, that's not the intent of these bills. These aren't going to hurt other things. Well, that's fine for him to say that here, but we have to go with the language that's in the bills. And as the bills exist right now, you would be eliminating owner-controlled insurance programs, OSIPs, CSIPs, builder's risk. All of those insurance programs are the result of contracts where, for example, the general contractor says, I'm going to procure insurance for everybody. Well, under this amendment, that agreement would no longer be valid. So I understand that the subcontractors group has an agenda they want to pass here. And as the Bar Association, we're not taking a position on that to say the subs are right, the generals are right. What we're saying is this particular bill has some real unintended consequences, some real problems. We'd be happy to sit down with the parties and try to either, one, come up with a compromise, or two, at least have the bar weigh in on the competing proposals so when they do come up to address the issue, which appears to be the concern, it doesn't have the unintended effect of eliminating OSIPs, CSIPs, builder's risk. And I could talk more about unintended consequences if you'd like. The bar has also said we're willing to set a deadline to say, hey, we'll do this by next September so that if that's not resolved, you know, these parties can all come back here next year and advance their agendas. And hopefully if that happens again, the bar will have eliminated the unintended consequences at that time. So with that being said, I'll take any questions members have.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I'm also going to note for the record, I received a message from a construction attorney, Patrick Lee O'Halloran, who says he could not be here, but says it's not as simple as the subcontractors say, but the construction contract and insurance law will be upset and uncertain. So make that communication on his behalf. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have two questions. One is to Mr. Sweeney from the railroads, because, and again, this is where this conflicting, I'm hearing conflicting testimony on these, that either the owner policy or the broad policy, so specifically on that railroad bridge, are you saying, is there something additional to railroads that Minneapolis could not get a, you know, an owner, whatever policy, and then they get the broad policy that covers the city of Minneapolis, a general contractor, and everybody else that's doing that bridge. I mean, this is where I'm getting conflicting from the two Mr. Smiths and others on if that type of policy would allow this, and then if the railroad track, you know, and the railroads adds a whole other layer of questions.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, it's a complication because of the unique status of railroad property when it comes to insurance policies. A general liability policy typically does not cover activity within 50 feet of a railroad track. So to fill that void, the city, the general contractor, somebody is going to have to acquire a railroad protective insurance policy to take care of all liability, not just ours, but everybody's liability in that construction within that zone. And as I said, one of the features of that policy is it does cover aspects of railroad negligence short of something such as sole negligence.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for the Bar Association. You said that 11 days ago you took a vote on this with the other construction lawyers at the bar. Did you then meet with the author and try to draft an amendment to this?
We did, and I should have mentioned that. We did not meet with the author that I know of, and I should apologize. There's a legislative subcommittee. The chair of that committee could not be here. He's been sort of handling this, if you will. He asked me to step in because he could not be here. I don't know if he's met with the author in particular. I think he, through the MSBA lobbyist, has introduced an amendment. I don't know that it's made its way to this committee, frankly. But the idea behind the MSBA's amendment would be to say, if we're not going to slow down and sort of push this a year and try to reach a consensus, to put in specific language to make sure that this is not going to affect OSIPs and CSIPs and builders' risk policies. So I do actually have copies of what we drafted, but I have to tell you I don't have the insight into where that stands in the legislative process.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Well, I find that surprising that you did not meet with the author, and she is shaking her head that nobody from Bar Association met with the author. So that was 11 days ago. You could have had a chance to affect this legislation if you thought it was as serious as you're saying that you think it is. So
sure.
Then I have my doubts about the seriousness of your
issues. Can I address that, Senator? So I believe what happened is we did send it through the MSBA. You know, we are a subsection of the MSBA. Through the MSBA lobbyists, this was sent to, I don't know if it made it to the senator or not, it was sent to the MSA.
I'm sorry, Mr. Smith, I'm going to interrupt. We have the lobbyist for the Bar Association here. Why don't we just let him address it? Mr. Lake?
Oh, here. Thank you. For the record, Brian Lake with the Minnesota State Bar Association. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Goodwin, just to understand the process, the bar has what other organizations sometimes think is a glacially slow process. So, yes, the meeting was 11 days ago. We have procedures that sections have to go through to take positions. This position wasn't taken until just a couple days ago. We just got amendment language yesterday. We're hoping to meet with Senator Jensen. I'm sorry. I apologize to Senator Jensen. We haven't had a chance to do that. But it wasn't 11 days ago that the section was approved to move forward. That was really just a couple days ago.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, one thing I'd like to point out and remind everyone is that this bill has been around for a couple years, and it's been heard in the House and it's been heard in the Senate and for a couple years. That I'm just amazed that the groups that have now wanting to put amendments have not gotten together before this time when this hearing has been scheduled. And I have met today with three groups, and I have told each one of them that I'm willing to hear what they have to say. But it's not going to affect my bringing this bill forward in the position and the shape that it's in right now, because I believe in this bill. I think it's a good bill, and it needs to move forward. So,
Senator Jensen, this bill, if it passes today, has another stop in the Commerce Committee.
That's correct.
There will also be time perhaps after that, if it moves beyond that stage for further discussions. So, Mr.
Yes.
Lake, you wanted to add something?
I just wanted to add one more thing, Mr. Chair. As Mr. Smith mentioned, the section was working on drafting an amendment, trying to do that on the fly quickly. We did send that to the MSA last week, Friday. Did not get a favorable response from them, and that's why we didn't move forward with that.
All right. So the record is clear. We've got another committee going to be coming into this room in about 8 minutes, so we are very limited on time. Senator Ortman, and then I think we're going to draw this one to a close.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that it's right that the author's been blindsided here with some opposition. I don't think that's right, and nobody wants to be sitting in that position. It's not right. However, I do think that there may be some legitimate concerns that should be considered by this committee and some amendments that should be discussed here. And I would ask the author to consider supporting tabling this bill for now so you have a chance to hear all those concerns, and maybe especially the railroad amendment seemed to be one of concern that I would think you would want to bring back to this committee. I would ask you to consider tabling the bill so you can work on it further, and I'll do what I can to help you.
Just so the record is clear, if the bill does not move out of this committee today, there will not be enough time this session for it to be heard in the other and Commerce Committee, so it will end the process for this year anyway for this bill.
Mr. Chair, what is the deadline that is imposing on this bill right now so that it couldn't be brought back at one of our later hearings this week?
It has to go to Commerce from here.
And, Mr. Chair, they only meet tomorrow.
Senator Goodwin, they only meet tomorrow. I guess, theoretically, it could be brought back here again on Friday. I don't know if we could even do the floor referral that fast. I don't know if the Commerce is meeting tomorrow. We got session on Thursday. So, theoretically, we could come back here on Friday, I think. All the staff are saying I'm calculating this accurately.
Mr. Chair and Senator Artman.
If Commerce turns the report around quickly.
My concern, Mr. Chair and Senator Artman. Like I said, this bill has been around for a couple years, and it's apparent that the relationship between contractors and subcontractors needs to be fixed, especially with the way things are going through the courts and how they're making rulings on this. So my concern is, if we delay, how long are we going to have to wait to fix this? And if we can't get it to go through this committee, and I can't get it to come back, I'm willing to come back if you can tell me that it's going to be able to be heard, but I'm concerned that that won't be a possibility. So I would prefer that we move this bill along and send it to Commerce if possible.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with Senator Jensen. I think moving along, and if there are some arrangements or amendments that she would like to put on the floor once it gets there, I think those things could be looked at by her and those people involved, but I'd like to move this forward.
Senator Hall, are you making a motion?
I am. I move that Senate file
561.
I don't think it's amended, is it?
It was amended.
We had the author's amendment.
As amended, would move forward and be moved to Commerce.
All right. Senator Hall moves that Senate file 561 as amended be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chair.
Be referred to Senate Commerce Committee. Senator Limmer before the vote.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jensen.
Yes.
If these other concerns can't be worked out by the time it's time to have a consideration on the Senate floor, if it gets that far, what would be your intent? Would your intent be to move your bill forward, knowing that there might be other extenuating issues that could affect other industries? Would you advance your bill knowing that and having the other senators vote for that on the Senate floor? Or I know you're going to try to work out the issues that are being raised right now, but
Senator Jensen.
I need to know.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, it is my intention that I will work with the groups that have expressed this concern, and I would not take it to the floor if I felt that it would be a negative impact to those concerns.
All right.
All right. Senator Hall's motion is before the committee. Senate file 561, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate Commerce Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Members, we are done for today. We will reconvene Thursday at noon and again at 6 p.m. It'll be our best effort to take up Senate file 388 first on the agenda Thursday night, since we didn't get to it today. And we're also meeting Friday at noon back in this room. We are adjourned.